We started the day with Frank. The middle bit of the sandwich was John. And now we come, for my money, I know I've said this, you know, you shouldn't have favourites, but this particular chap is my favourite. No, listen, but this guy that was very special, we have saved the best till last. Will you please put your hands together, and please welcome my friend and yours, Mr. Ken Park.
Before I start, everyone who wants one, have you got my information pack? Everyone who wants one has got one. Yes? No? Come and get one of these each, yeah? Guy at the back, do you want one? Want one of these? No? Okay. Sure. There we go. Before I start, I need to sort of crave your indulgence a little bit. A lot of you will know I've been very ill for a long time, and I'm recovering, in fact, from 3 months in hospital. I got struck down with sepsis and everything switched off. Heart, lungs, liver, kidneys, and then I got pneumonia twice and lesions on my spine. It was not a good time. Then it took me 3 months to learn to walk again, because I couldn't walk. And I lost 5 stone in weight, which I put back on!
Yeah.
I was 14 stone and went down to 9. I didn't look very nice, I'll tell you. It has taken me a long time to recover. But I am well on the way now, and I'm back doing my talks, back on radio, Radio Merseyside, Radio Wirral as well. My new DVD documentary series is coming out in about 3 weeks' time. 8 half-hour documentaries on a single DVD. You're late!
Yeah.
Terrible this, isn't it? I don't know. Been down to bingo. And that's coming out too. So I'm back into getting into the swing of things. But I have difficulty standing for any length of time. And I can't walk as much as I used to. Will you please allow me to sit while I'm giving this talk? That means some of you won't be able to see me, but that's no disadvantage. So just bear with me. Okay. The leaflet pack I've given you are all my books and CDs. It's information on all of those. Plus, on the outside is my latest list of all the talks that I have. There's about 40 of them in my repertoire. So if any of you are members of any other groups or organisations that have speakers and you'd like me to come and talk to you, choose the talk, give me a call, and we'll sort it all out. I have brought some books with me, but ones I thought would be particularly of interest are these two, my Merseyside Tales and More Merseyside Tales. These are the strangest, oddest, most unusual stories you've ever heard from right across Liverpool and Merseyside, very well illustrated. But all the stories are perfectly true, absolutely. If I declare as a historian that what I'm telling you is true, it is. Take it to the bank. Because I will always only ever say that if I've got 2, preferably 3, credible sources for all the things that I write and publish. I'm currently writing my 13th book, and that'll be in the shops by Christmas. Why? Because there's so much to tell about this wonderful city, and not just Liverpool, but all of Merseyside. You know, the world really does revolve around us. We are the centre of the universe. Why? Because we represent the universe. This city is made up of diversity. Everybody came here from somewhere else. And that's what I love about this city, because we are a totally artificially invented city. It didn't exist before 1207. We're not in the Doomsday Book, because we're so insignificant. William the Conqueror put this great ledger together in 1086 of everything he could tax. If it moved, he taxed it. If it didn't move, he taxed it twice because people couldn't object. And everywhere's in it. Toxteth is in the Doomsday Book. Wavertree, Woolton, Mells, Birkenhead, Chester. I mean, all these places are in. Walton, Kirkdale, all in the Doomsday Book. But you will not find Liverpool because it didn't exist. One of the things about Liverpool, and this is the subject of my talk today, is the fact that it is built on 7 hills. Now, there are downside more than Seven Hills in Liverpool, as anyone who rides a push bike will know. I always remember having to ride up Gattaca Brow as a kid on my bike and saying, the minute I get my licence and I'm old enough to have a car, the first hill I'm going to drive up was Gattaca Brow. And that's what I did too. I used to like cycling out to Runcorn and Widnes and places like that. But there are seven major hills that make up Liverpool. And this is why I like to say we are just like Rome. That's known as the Eternal City. We are the Eternal City. We may have only been official since 1207, but you know our oldest relic are the Calderstones. They date from 5000 BC, which makes them 7000 years old. Now, Stonehenge is only 4000 years old. Because that's like 2,500 BC. And the oldest pyramid in Egypt is only 2,000 years old, because that was sort of, I think, BC 1,000 or something like that. So Scousers, in one form or another, have been around a long time, so we're pretty eternal too. Rome is built on seven hills. Well, so are we. They are Walton Hill, Everton Brow, or Ridge, High Park in Toxteth, or the Toxteth Ridge, so we're on top of one of the seven hills here, Mossley Hill, the Olive Mount and Wavertree Ridge, that's a long one, the Chilwell and Walton Ridge, they're all part of the same high plain, and Camp Hill. Edge Hill, contrary to popular opinion, is not a hill. And anyone who knows Edge Hill will tell you it's not a hill. The clue is in the name. It's actually the end of Everton Ridge, so the edge of the hill. That's where it comes from. It's also a boundary between the ancient manors of Toxteth and West Derby. So it's the edge of both manors. So that's why Edge Lane is called Edge Lane, because the edge of the boundaries. Nothing to do with the hills at all. Low Hill, Copperas Hill, and Brownlow Hill are flanks of other hills. They're not hills in their own right, although they are quite high. The first Low Hill is a flank of Everton Ridge, and the second two, Copperas Hill and Brownlow Hill, are actually the ends of the Toxteth Ridge. And if you look at the Ordnance Survey maps, you can see this very clearly. But I brought with me a map of the seven hills. And if you'd like to come and have a look at this later on, then please do. Because it really is quite fascinating. Indeed, the word low is Anglo-Saxon for hill. So if you've got that sort of name for a hill, you can pretty well bank on it being at some point an Anglo-Saxon chieftain's burial tumulus. At some point, an Anglo-Saxon chieftain would have been buried there with all his treasure and everything else. However, there is little doubt that Low Hill, which therefore simply means Hill Hill, and Brownlow Hill are a reminder of the ancient Saxon chieftains who once ruled this area, although Brownlow Hill was specifically named after Mr. Lawrence Brownlow, who in the 18th century owned much property in the district. So that's purely a coincidence. During Anglo-Saxon times, these burial mounds were erected on the higher hills of Liverpool, and there are many of them located all over Liverpool and Merseyside, and of course all around Britain. Another one is Spellow Hill, Spellow Lane, top of Spellow Lane. In fact, where Goodison Park now sits is the top of Spellow Lane. Spellow is Anglo-Saxon for Speech Hill. It's where the local parliament used to be held, and it's also now believed that a chieftain was buried there as well, all long since gone. So if the match is particularly bad on a Saturday afternoon and you're getting bored, don't go digging in the pitch to see what you can find. There's nothing there. Now, the Spellow Lane Hill is a flank of Walton Hill and rises to where Everton Football Club has its home at Goodison Park, as I say. Now, each of our seven hills, all of them have had settled communities living on them at some point for centuries, in some cases for 1,000 years or more. But some, especially Olive Mount and Camp Hill, had prehistoric settlements on them. Walton had a pagan community. The Druids used to have a settlement on the top of Walton Hill, and it's believed, according to Roman writings, carry out human sacrifices on the top of Walton Hill. The first point in the northwest of England that the early Christians came to convert the pagans to Christianity was Walton. Absolutely, the first place was Walton. That's why it became so important. And they deliberately, as the early Christians always did, built their churches, their places of worship, right smack bang on the top of wherever they found a pagan temple, to say, the old gods are dead, this is the new God, worship Jesus. And Walton was there. Everton and Toxteth had very early medieval settlements, and Mossley Hill and Chilwell all had later enclaves of the merchant classes, the middle classes, in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. They made their homes there. Now, there are wonderful stories associated with the peoples of all these hills. I haven't got time to tell you them all, but I have promised to tell you 7 stories from the 7 hills. 1 story for each hill. So let's begin with the most important of all of these, Walton on the Hill. Now here, I could tell you about the ancient pagans and the Druids and the standing stone temple that was there when the first Christians came here from Lindisfarne, about the 8th or 7th or 8th century. It was torn down by the first Christians sometime around about 650 AD, we think, and the first church made of wattle and daub and thatch erected on the hill. But I'm not going to tell you about that. I could tell you about the Tudor school that was built alongside the church, and of course which still stands at Walton on the Hill, next to the Black Horse pub, between that and the graveyard. It was built around 1515, during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. There's lots of stories associated with that particular building, and I'm not going to tell you any of them. Instead, I'm going to tell you about Walton Zoological Gardens and Ponga. Now, the Liverpool Zoological Park and Gardens opened in 1884 on what is now Sainsbury's site on Rice Lane, opposite the old Walton Hospital. Know what I'm talking about? Long since disappeared. Of course, Sainsbury's itself was built on the site of the Dunlop Factory. Dunlop Factory built on the site of the zoo. It covered 30 acres of the zoological gardens. Lots of animals in a variety of settings. There were beautiful gardens, a hotel, shops, a tea room, all built around a quadrangle, planted with linden trees, and the publicity leaflets at the time said, to form a sylvan promenade for alfresco concerts. You can imagine that in the middle of Rice Lane. Go ahead. Most popular attraction, though, was the half-timbered monkey house, in which could be found Pongo, the man-monkey. He was a large chimpanzee who could so mimic the actions of people that many people actually believed it was a man in a monkey suit. But he wasn't. He was a real chimpanzee. Now, the zoo closed early in the 1900s, but there are remnants of it. Anyone know what remains of the zoo? Yeah, you had your hand up first. Do you know what it was?
Was it gated?
It was the ticket office and gatehouse. And yes, you're absolutely right. It actually stands next to the Lux Garden restaurant and the pub, in between the plough and the...
It's a pizza parlour.
Yeah, you're right. It's been all sorts. At the moment, it's a pizza parlour. It's got a domed roof, and there's this beautiful piece of plasterwork on the front over the rectangular window. And if you go up and have a look closely at it, it's monkeys swinging on vines carved in relief in the plaster. It's amazing how it survived. If you actually have a look at the building, to the left of the window is what all that remains of the turnstile that originally took you into the zoological gardens. And if you go around the back of the building, the plaster at the front is replicated on the back of the building as well. It's mirrored, only that one hasn't been looked after at all and hasn't been painted. Cobs of it are falling off, which is a great shame. The Liverpool Rubber Company bought the site in 1926, and this became part of the Dunlop Rubber Company's footwear division. In the 1930s, the factory employed 3,000 people, it's a huge site, and produced 140,000 pairs of rubber boots and shoes every week. Major employer, major producer. The Prince of Wales pub on Rice Lane, near the zoo, was visited by King Edward VII after he'd been to the zoo, and he declared the pub to be a sod house. That's what he christened it, as a sod house, because the landlord used to keep, didn't have a cellar, he used to keep his barrels of beer on the bar, and to keep them cool, he moistened sods of earth and grass, turf, and draped them over the top of the barrels. That's how he got it. He kept watering them to keep them cool. So King Edward VII called it the sod house. There's still a zoo of sorts in Walton, of course, the Rice Lane City Farm. And it can be found at the end of Rawcliffe Road in the grounds of Walton Cemetery. If any of you have not been to the Rice Lane City Farm, go have a look at it. It's a hand-to-mouth venture, as they haven't got two apennies to rub together, but they do a fabulous job of keeping that city farm going in the height, the heart of an urban wall. It's well worth going to see.
It's got the grave of Robert Trestle.
Absolutely.
The and ragged Trestle philanthropist author.
Yeah, they dedicated a sculpted bust of Robert Trestle about 2 or 3 months ago, I think, the sculpture was up. And they didn't want to actually position it in the graveyard for vandals, it wouldn't have survived. So the artist, the sculptor, has donated it to the Museum of Liverpool, we're delighted to have it, and it's going to have a special exhibition location in the museum before the end of the year. You're right, Robert Trestle is buried there. A lot of paupers' graves there as well, great areas of unmarked mass graves. A lot of the people who died in the Walton Workhouse, which became Walton Hospital, are buried in mass graves, of course, in Walton Cemetery. Which brings me to the next hill, Everton Brow or Ridge. I could tell you about the founding of Everton Football Club, and why it's called the People's Club, but I won't. Or Everton Beacon, that once stood where St George's Church now stands on the top of Everton Ridge. It was probably built, the beacon, around 1220, probably on the orders of King Henry III. I'm not going to tell you about that either. Or I could tell you about Molly Bushell and her famous toffee shop, but I won't. Instead, I'm going to tell you about Prince Rupert and the lost treasure of old Liverpool. Liverpool changed hands three times during the English Civil Wars, 1642, that's right, yes, till 1651. There were a number of civil wars, there wasn't just the one, of course. Now, when the war broke out in 1642, we are a parliamentarian town. Well, we've always been left-wing in Liverpool, perfectly reasonable, except we had two great wealthy aristocrats in the town. The Earls of Derby, who owned the Tower of Liverpool, you know we had a tower, as grisly as the Tower of London, stood at the bottom of Water Street where Tower Buildings now stands. That was owned by the Stanleys, it was large, they had their own garrison of troops there, because they were kings of the Isle of Man, and ruled the Isle of Man from Peel Castle on the island, but would take troops over there if they need to keep the maximum down at any point, they were garrisoned in the tower. Then the Molyneux family, who became the Earls of Sefton, of course, they were hereditary constables of Liverpool Castle. You know we had a castle. Right in the middle of Derby Square it stood, where Queen Victoria is now, and it pretty well filled all of that square. So, of course, as soon as the war is declared, these two aristocrats declare for the king and declare the town as a royalist town. Well, we can't do much about that, because the Molyneux are lord of the manor anyway. We're paying our rents and our dues to them, can't do anything without paying a fee to the Molyneux family. Apart from that, they've got a garrison of troops in their castle, glowering down on us, as have the Stanleys in the tower, so we better just keep quiet about it. But we're not particularly happy. The population of Liverpool was then at about 1,000 people. There were about 2,500 people in the town when the war broke out, but 1,500 of them just hightailed it out of there as soon as the war was declared, because they knew Liverpool with its castle, with its tower, with a large collection of treasure and gold bullion kept in the dungeons of the castle, was going to be a prime target for the king, as was the hoard of 100 barrels of gunpowder. So it was clear that Liverpool was going to be attacked. So they all left and went, left 1,000 people in the town. In 1644, King Charles, declared for the king in 1642. Then the parliamentarians actually besieged the town and reclaimed it for Parliament, because by this time the Molyneux had taken their army out of the castle and left a small garrison of only about 24 men there. Derby and all his troops had left the tower and were off fighting for the king. So there were no troops guarding the town. So we felt safe to let the parliamentarians in. And we now declare for the parliamentarians again. We were very happy. There was still Lord Molyneux left in the castle, but only with, as I say, about a dozen or so men. But now he couldn't do anything about it because he's outnumbered. Parliamentarians come in and occupy the town. We know that King Charles pretty soon is going to come and want the town back. So we build a great wall around the town, which is tiny, because it doesn't go much beyond halfway along Old Hall Street, roughly where the Echo building is now. It goes down as far as the end of Dale Street, where the Churchill Way flyover is, because that's where the creek ran. So that was the eastern boundary of the town, and down as far as the river. It's tiny. We put a wall all the way around it. Sure enough, 1644, Prince Rupert of the Rhine, on the orders of King Charles I, marches to attack and recapture Liverpool for the king. Doesn't attack it straight away. He wants to plan his attack. We know he's coming. So we evacuate all the women and children over the water to Wallasey, Egremont and Seacombe. So there's about 500 men and youths defending the town behind that wall. Rupert makes his way up to the top of Everton Ridge, where he commandeers a cottage right next door to where Molly Bushell would start making her toffee about 50 years later. But at the time, it's just another cottage, just the two cottages side by side. He commandeers one as his wartime headquarters. And he stands on the ridge and he looks down. It's a perfect vantage point. He can see all the town arrayed before him. And he stands there, a real fop, all lace and velvet and gold buckles and curly ringlets. And velvet and lace round his sleeves. 22 years old he is. He went everywhere with a monkey on a lead that used to sit on his shoulder and a spaniel, not a King Charles spaniel, I hasten to add. And he stood and looked at the town and went, "Pshaw, this is naught but a nest of crows that a parcel of boys could take." Oh, yes. Oh, yes, Rupert old fruit. Well, if that's the case, why did you feel it necessary, knowing as you did there's only 500 of us, to come here with 10,000 troops and cavalry and cannon? Why? Because he knew even then you take on a scouser at your bell. He arrayed his cannon along a ridge where we now know as Lime Street, okay? And it's higher than the rest of the town. It's halfway up the hill. It's now Lime Street. From where the Duke of Wellington's monument now stands to where Dickie Lewis stands in all his relative glory, he put all his cannon aimed towards the town. He bombarded it for 18 days continuously, 24 hours a day. Just continuously bombarded the town. In the process, he killed 49 of us. Now, we're not taking this. We're not putting up with this. We are bombarding him back because we're fairly well armed too. And in the process, we killed 1,500 of his troops and we're going nowhere. He does capture the town, though. How? Treachery. He's in communication secretly with Lord Molyneux in the castle of Liverpool. They're exchanging secret messages. They hatch a plan. In the dead of night, when the siege has stopped, the shelling, cannonade has stopped, Lord Molyneux and about six or seven of his men make their way up Old Hall Street, as I say, roughly to where the Echo building is now, where the wall was. Now, there's a couple of lads on sentry duty at the end of the wall there, and Lord Molyneux, who, remember, is the Lord of the Manor. And there may be a civil war going on, parliamentarians v. royalists, but we're still a feudal society, a class-ridden society. When the Lord of the Manor says to you, "Okay, my men, I'm dismissing you, go back to your homes in the town," you do as you're told. And that's what they did. It was ingrained in them to do it. It may be, of course, he said to them, "All right, lads, you fancy an early dart? All right, Governor, we will get our heads down." I mean, it could be one of the two, but whatever. They deserted their post and went into the town. Dead of night, no street lights. It's a moonless night because it's thick cloud. Perfect what they had planned. Soon as they're on their road, Molyneux and his men hack a hole through the wall. They breach the wall. In the meantime, Rupert and now his 8,500 troops are making their way down from Everton Ridge through the Kirkdale Forest. Yes, Kirkdale was all forest, the eaves of which were where the Radisson Hotel now stands at Old Hall Street. And they were waiting under the eaves, and they muffled their spurs and their cutlasses and everything, so they weren't rattling or making the noise. Did it so quietly. As soon as Molyneux and his men have hacked a hole through the wall, they whistle a signal, and Rupert and his troops pour through the breach in the defences. Mm. In fact, Lord Carol Molyneux is side by side with Prince Rupert, and the two of them are hacking and slashing everyone they come across in the town. Molyneux is massacring his own men. Not only did he betray his town, his manor, his people, but he's slaughtering them too. In fact, they massacred just about everyone in the town. And reports at the time say, all were slaughtered, near 400 men, some that had never borne arms, yea, even one poor blind man. And they burned the town to the ground, except for the castle and except for the tower, because they were owned by aristocrats. He was only in the town for 9 days, Rupert, with his troops, because all of a sudden he gets a message from the king saying, "Right, I need you now outside York. There's going to be a big battle. Bring all your troops, all your men, and make your way straight to York." He did, deserted the town. He left a very small garrison to man the town, and he took the treasure with him back up to Everton Ridge. He emptied out all the gold and the treasure from the dungeons of the castle, took it up to Everton Ridge. He couldn't take it with him to York, where, by the way, it was the Battle of Marston Moor, and he was roundly defeated by the parliamentarians of Cromwell. But the treasure is up on the hill at Everton. He can't take it with him because it's too heavy. So he delegates two cavaliers, two royalist soldiers, to guard the treasure, to take it into the tunnels under his cottage and under Everton Ridge. Liverpool, as you well know, is a warren of tunnels, passageways and caves. That was the last that was ever heard of the treasure of Liverpool. It has never, ever been discovered. And no one knows where it is. Although, after the war, around 1948, they were rebuilding the bombed parts of Brunswick Street and Castle Street, been heavily bombed during the war. They're rebuilding all of that, building what was now Beetham Plaza, where the bucket fountain is. Right? And as they're digging down the foundations for all those post-war buildings, their Navi's pneumatic drill just keeps going through the floor. And they've discovered this cavern, this passageway, this tunnel. They're calling archaeologists in the University of Liverpool and the Clerk of Works and the Corporation. Everything stops on the work. And they discover this is a tunnel leading down to the river. One of at least six tunnels under Liverpool that lead down to the river. They're in various places. And going back up towards Everton. It only got as far as just beyond the town wall, sort of under Victoria Street, where where there'd been obviously a major roof collapse, and it had all been completely blocked. They couldn't get beyond it, so couldn't tell whether it went up to Everton or not. What did they find? Sticking out of some rocks in this rock fall, in the middle of this tunnel, 1948, two pairs of skeletal feet with boots, cavalier boots. They dug out what they could, but they could only get the legs, and they found what was left of velvet trousers, hose, buckled boots. I mean, the rumour went round, of course. Could these have been the two cavaliers that were supposed to have had the treasure? Were they trying to have it away down to the river and row it away to get it to the king? We'll never know, of course. I often wonder where those skeletons went to. I've been in touch with the museum who know about the story, but have no evidence at all as to what happened to these alleged skeletal feet. I reckon some scouse has got them in his garden shed somewhere. Had them there for years. But it did give rise, of course, to the belief again that the treasure's still under Liverpool somewhere. Now, by this time, the Everton Ridge is covered in back-to-back houses, court dwellings, terraces, and everything. It's only in the 80s, when they start demolishing all that, the 70s and the 80s, and building the tower blocks, and in fact, after they started demolishing all the tower blocks again, that all that open land at the top of Everton Ridge was exposed. Then the entrance to the old cave, under where Molly Bush's original cottage used to be, was exposed. And the fire brigade and the police were having endless trouble. They were having to go and extricate drunken scouse lads who'd gone down the pub, had a skillful tip. She gone find Rupert's steady, lads. She is somewhere. Come on, lads, let's go and have a tick. They would always get stuck in the cave, so the corporation actually put great iron sheets over the entrance to the tunnel, grassed it and turfed it over. Nobody, apart from archaeologists from the university, the, I don't know which department it would be, in the city council, might be the planning department or environment, I don't know, but the city council know, and me, I know where the entrance to the tunnel. So I would say to my wife, Jack, if our pension doesn't deliver, you know, we'll get a hard hat and a shovel, and we'll have a go down under there. So if you're stuck for something to do, you know, one Sunday afternoon, go down and see me, we're fine. Which brings me to where we are now, Toxteth Ridge. I could go on about the ancient chapel at Toxteth, where Cromwell watered his horses, as a matter of record, at the brook that used to run down. The road that is now Park Road was a brook that ran all the way down. It dried up with the industrialisation and the building of all the houses on the hill and around Toxteth in the latter years of the 19th century. It dried up, but used to lead all the way down to the Dingle, which was once a beautiful glade. But I'm not going to tell you about that. And I'm not going to tell you about the Dingle, where people used to go swimming in Knott's Hole, which is now where the Britannia pub is. Rather poor restaurant. I don't recommend it since it's been done up. It's awful. That's just a personal view. But that was where Notto was. Used to go swimming. It was a beautiful silver glade, the Dingle, till it all became oil dumps and everything else. But I'm not going to tell you about that. Or I could tell you about the Stoker State of Forest, which is one of the other reasons why King John came here in 1207. Not only did he find that there was this huge, great tidal inlet big enough to anchor a fleet of 100 warships to invade Ireland and everywhere else from. Now, warships are tiny in those days in comparison to what we would consider large now. So 100 medieval ships is not a vast area, but big enough. The pool was big enough. In fact, all of Liverpool One, all of it, and the Paradise Street bus station sits on what was the pool. So it was fairly big. Started halfway down Paradise Street and then came all the way down to the river. But he needed wood to build his warships from. And lo and behold, on the southern flanks of the pool is the Stoker State of Forest. 3,000 acres of it. Deciduous trees, mostly oak, deer, wild boar, rabbit, hare, pheasants. He declared it his own hunting ground, put a wall all the way around it, built two lodges, of course. But I'm not going to tell you anything about that at all. I'm going to instead talk about the lost community of Willerloo. Anyone ever heard of Willerloo? Okay. By the middle decades of the 19th century, in what is now the north end of South Street in Toxteth, is the area known as the Welsh Streets. Madryn Street, we all know the Welsh Streets. A small community of single and two-story cottages had grown up in that area, well before the Welsh Streets was even a twinkle in anybody's eye. And this community of cottages was known as Willerloo. It was surrounded mostly by open heathland, watered by a few brooks and streams, and was quite an isolated community. It was miles away from anywhere. Nevertheless, it was a busy one, with three very popular beer houses, early forms of pub, named after their landlords, Chadwicks, Brookfields, and Lees. Also on the site of the present Winstay, Violus, Rulus, and Powis streets, not far from modern Prince's Road and Prince's Park gates, stood a large tannery yard. Workers from here and from the nearby Dingle Iron Foundry in Horsfall Street, known as the Mersey Forge, as well as from a large ship's carpenter's works on the riverfront, would pack these watering holes regularly, as would local residents, especially on Sundays. Nobody went to church in Willerloo. They spent the entire Sunday in the pub getting legless. It was very popular with sailors, Willerloo, too, because of the cheap ale and even cheaper women, whose morals and fees were very flexible, and because this was a place where virtually anything went. Deals were done, contraband bought and sold, and drunkenness was the general condition. This became a notorious community, well known around Liverpool town as a hub of nefarious doings, dastardly deeds, and for disturbance and disorder. It was a rough, tough, and uncompromising neighbourhood where at least two or three bouts of bare-knuckle boxing would take place every Sunday evening just before dinner time, so everyone could work up an appetite. These attracted large crowds of spectators, fueled gambling, led to frequent and vicious fights amongst the crowds, as everyone wanted to join in, all working up an appetite, as I say, for a hearty evening meal. In fact, anyone who just wanted a good fight, not for fun, if not for profit, would start in on any likely candidate standing around. And these would often grow into a bloody melee of writhing, bruised and broken male bodies, although dozens of women would often join in the fight as well, fighting between themselves and in amongst the men. Many an old score was settled in the beer houses and streets of Willerloo, and many new feuds began there too. This became such a tradition, especially in the 1830s, that official lookouts would be posted to keep cavey for the Rozzers. But there were only two police constables in the entire district, whose names were Officers Lunt and Lowy, and they were based in the Toxteth Bridewell in Cotter Street, which was over half a mile away, which no longer exists. Cotter Street's long since gone. This meant that the fights were only very rarely officially broken up. Nevertheless, the beer houses became notorious and Willerloo infamous as a district that was not for the faint-hearted or for those of a nervous or sensitive disposition. Chadwick's and Brookfield's beer houses had closed by 1880, but Lees survived well into the 1920s. In fact, my granddad used to drink in Lees, used to tell me all these tales himself. However, Willerloo itself has long gone, replaced by ranks of Victorian houses that transformed the open heathland of old Toxteth into the working-class hinterland of modern Liverpool 8. Isn't this fascinating? Do you know, I didn't know any of this until I came here this afternoon. That's great. How are we doing for time? My God, it's 3:15, and I've only got three hills done here. Are you all right for a bit?
Yeah.
Mossley Hill. I could tell you about Mickey the Chimp, who I call Liverpool's King Kong, but I'm not. But that's all right, because you buy my books, and all the tales I'm not telling you are in those books. Or about the magnificent church of St. James and St. Matthew, which is on the top of Mossley Hill. Most people just call it Mossley Hill Church. Did you know that was the first church to be bombed during the Second World War anywhere in Britain? First church in Britain to be bombed. And they had to completely rebuild and restore and reconsecrate it again. It was reconsecrated and opened up in 1951. But I'm not going to tell you about that. I was, in fact, going to tell you about the tale of the Carnatic and the Mentor, but you've all been here for John, haven't you? You've all heard that tale? No. How many of you did not know the story of the Carnatic and the Mentor? Just about everyone. You've heard it. Do you mind hearing it again? My version is slightly different. His is accurate, but mine is slightly different. Opposite the Dale Halls of Residence across Elmwood Drive on Mossley Hill stand the Carnatic Halls of Residence for the University of Liverpool, of course. These occupy the site of what was once Carnatic Hall, the home of Peter Baker, who was an 18th century Liverpool shipbuilder. And he was rubbish. He was dreadful. He had a reputation for being the worst shipbuilder Liverpool had ever produced, and we produced a few. This was particularly clear when he built the 400-ton ship, the Mentor, for a private buyer. The ship was a disaster because she was so badly designed, inexpertly constructed, that she listed to one side and was difficult to manoeuvre at sea. Naturally, the buyer refused to take possession of the ship. So Baker decides to captain it himself and take it to sea. Now, this was at a time when, again, those of you who heard John talk before, when one of Liverpool's main sources of maritime income were privateer ships. When you could license yourself as a privateer, getting a permission slip from the government, known as a letter of marque, and you were allowed to arm your vessel and go after any ship of any country that Britain happened to be at war with at the time, which could have been just about anyone at any time, because at some time or other, we were certainly at war with the French, and the Spanish, and the Dutch, and the Americans, of course, so it was fair game. And anything you captured from that, you give a quarter to the government and you kept the rest for yourself. Very, very profitable. And the town of Liverpool would charge privateers for anchoring in the port, even if they were Liverpool-owned ships, for loading and unloading. So Liverpool was making money on the deal and everybody was happy. This was no more than authorised piracy. And so Baker and the Mentor decided to go out themselves as privateers, but him and his ship were the joke of the town. I mean, the only crew he could get to crew his ship were a gang of ragtag ruffians, thugs, drunkards, people who had no real experience at sea. They're the only people who would be stupid enough to actually sign up on this ship, which everyone believed would sink as soon as it got out to the bar. These men were as rough as they were ready and were only tempted by the prospect of a rich prize. And so was the captain, because Baker himself thought better of all of this. He thought, actually, I don't think I want to go on board this ship that I've built anyway. It's clearly a wreck. So he appointed, it's all right, I knew you were going, they're not fed up. He appointed his friend, John Dawson, to be captain of the ship. Now, he was a man of little experience at sea, but because he was badly in debt, he saw this voyage as a chance to clear his debts, and it would be a way of changing his fortunes. Little did he know, he was absolutely correct. Whilst at sea, on the 28th of October, 1778, purely by chance, and thinking that she was a Spanish man of war, Dawson, aboard the Mentor, stumbled across the Carnatic. The captain was faced with a problem, though, because the Mentor carried only 28 guns, whereas the opponent, and he could see through his telescope, had 78 guns. Now, just as Dawson was about to turn tail and run, because there's no way he's going to take on this ship, So the mentor's carpenter pointed out to Dawson that actually the Carnatic was only carrying dummy guns. They weren't real ones. One of the few people on board the ship who had any seagoing experience at all. So Dawson fired a few warning shots across what was now revealed as being a French vessel. So as soon as he fired the shots, immediately, of course, the French surrendered. Just instantly surrendered. The mentor's crew boarded Carnatic and claimed her as an English prize of war. To Dawson's amazement, when they took an inventory of her cargo, they discovered that she was carrying vast quantities of exotic spices and other trade goods worth then £400,000. And if you translate that up to modern currency, that's £29 million, just in foreign currency and exotic spices and trade goods. The cargo also included a box of diamonds, valued then at £135,000, today £10 million. This purely by chance, the gods were smiling on Peter Dawson and the mentor. The news reached Liverpool before the mentor, and as she drew near the dockside of her home port, church bells were ringing out, cheering crowds, which included the ecstatic Peter Baker who built the ship, are lining the wharf, cheering and shouting. Whereas they've been spitting at the ship and jeering at it when it sailed away, now, oh, congratulations, well done, welcome home with your multi-million pound haul. The mentor's crew were now rich men. Baker was wealthy beyond his wildest dreams. He bought the manor of Garston as a result and became lord of the manor of Garston. But he didn't stop there, because Mentor went on to capture two more prizes before foundering in a storm off Newfoundland 3 years later with, tragically, the loss of all aboard except the captain, the mate and the cabin boy. Nevertheless, Baker went on to live a happy and very comfortable life in his mansion, which he had built from the proceeds of the Carnatic. This was on the site of a previous stately home, originally known as Mossley Hill Hall, but he pulled all that down and built the Carnatic. Baker's new house was actually ironically called Carnatic Hall by local wags, but not minding this in the least, Baker decided to adopt the name for his new and stately home. He was elected mayor of Liverpool in 1795, but he died in February the following year while still in office at the age of 64. From 1830 to 1838, Carnatic Hall was occupied by William Ewart and his son John, who became an MP for Liverpool, and John's friend and former employee, Matthew Glenton, later amassed a fortune. It was he, in fact, who went on to build Mossley Hill Church. The hall then passed through various owners when in 1890, during major renovations, the building caught fire and was razed to the ground. Despite this, the estate was purchased by a wealthy ship owner, Walter Holland, who built a new 60-room house on the site and renamed that Carnatic Hall. It was the glory of the neighbourhood. People used to come and see it, tour around and look at it, particularly to see the 24 peacocks that were on the lawn and listen to them as well. However, the last owner of the house and the estate died in 1931. It remained empty until 1946, when it became a storehouse for Liverpool Museum. In fact, some of the treasures of the museum and the Walker Art Gallery were stored at Carnatic Hall during the war to protect them from the Blitz. And so it remained until 1964, when the last Carnatic Hall was demolished to make way for the student accommodation that now occupies the site. Fifth Hill. Are we all right still? Olive Mount, Wavertree Ridge. I could tell you about the prehistoric settlement and the burial mounds up there, but I won't. I could tell you about the well and the Cistercian monks. The well is still there, the monks' well, but I won't. I could tell you about the haunted mill and the demon of the quarry, which is directly opposite the Blue Coat School. All that was a quarry, and the quarry was filled in with rubbish. It was known as the Bin Field. and all the houses, Truro Road and all those, they're forever subsiding because the ground is unstable. It's also known as one of the most haunted parts of Liverpool because of this story of the demon that lived in the bottom of the quarry. It's a fascinating story, which I'm not going to tell you either. Instead, I'm going to tell you about Wavertree Lockup and the Village Green. You know the lockup? Yeah? The spring beneath Monk's Well, that's still there, but it's culverted now, once fed a lake in Wavertree Village. You know where the playground is? Bottom of Mill Lane, by the lockup. That was a lake. That's why that little road that runs between the playground and lockup is called Lake Road. It was filled in during the 20s, as I say, it's now a playground. But the stream used to run from there. It was known as the Upper Brook. And it ran under the Coffee House Club in the village, under Wavertree Playground, which we know better as the Mystery, under the Brook House Pub, which is why it's called the Brook House Pub, and on into Greenbank Park Lake. It then continues into the University Halls of Residence Lake, then into Sefton Park Lake, and runs under Egbert Vale, down through Otterspool Park and Promenade, and into the Mersey. All rises from the Monk's Well in Wavertree. Now the lake, as well as the large number of inns and taverns in the village, from the mid-18th century, were a tourist attraction. People would walk up from Liverpool, it's only 2.5-3 miles, and would picnic and go swimming, because where the Abbey Cinema was built was part of the heath, the Chilwell Heath, known also as Wavertree Green. All the land was the green, in fact, the public common land, so they'd picnic there, go drinking in all the taverns, and they'd get legless, of course, which caused a problem for the villagers. So in 1796, the villagers decided they had to do something about all these drunken tourists, so they built the Bridewell. Interestingly enough, around the same year, in Everton, the villagers in Everton built their Bridewell, which still stands, for the same reason. Tourists coming up the hill, getting legless in the taverns, and making a nuisance of themselves, same in Wavertree. But Wavertree decided to appoint a local sheriff, first sheriff actually appointed in Liverpool, village sheriff. He was even provided with the first truncheon and the first pair of handcuffs, and I think they're still on display in the Museum of Liverpool. They also bought him a handcart, and his job was to wheel this big handcart outside the thatched house, the coffee house, up Mill Lane, and outside all the pubs, where the landlords would turf out into the tracks all the drunkards. He would shovel them up, wheel them down Mill Lane, put them in the lockup, and lock them up. He was paid tuppence for every drunkard he locked up every night that he kept them locked up. So that was his deal. Nice little earner, because there were plenty of drunks. The only thing is, in the middle of the night, the roof of the Bridewell was then flat, not pointed like it is now. Victorians did that. It was flat, and only laths and thatch and plaster. So the friends and relatives of all the drunkards would put ladders up the side of the Bridewell, knock holes in, lower ropes down, and haul out all the drunks. Well, that was great as far as the sheriff was concerned. He just arrested them again the following day and locked them up again, with another tuppence each for them. It was also part of his contract to keep the Bridewell in an excellent state of repair and weatherproof. So all the holes that were knocked in the roof were making him money as well. This sheriff was on a very nice little earner, and he did very well out of it. He made quite a living. I'm very conscious of time, so I want to press on and see if I can get all the 7 stories in. I'm going to talk about Chilwell and Woolton to finish off. Chilwell Hill. I could tell you about Chilwell Hall. It was built by Bamber Gascoigne, the ancestor of our university, challenged Bamber Gascoigne, but I'm not going to. I could tell you about the Chilwell Abbey Inn, parts of which date from the early 15th century. But I won't. I could tell you about the church as well. It's the oldest church, the oldest Saxon church, within the boundary of Liverpool, but I'm not. But I am going to tell you about part of the church. I'm going to tell you about the hagioscope, which is the official name for a leper's squint. Any of you heard of the leper squint of children? Yes? Good man. Leprosy was common across Britain from around the 12th century, particularly in and around towns like Liverpool. Now, the dreadful disfigurement that comes with this often highly contagious disease was seen by many as divine punishment for sins. But it affected men, women, and children. But because A, they were tainted with sin, and B, it was highly contagious, lepers were consigned to outside the local communities, to colonies, leper colonies. And there were a lot of lepers, leprosy was rife. 13th, 14th, 15th centuries in Liverpool. And there was a leper colony in Chewell Valley. In fact, if you go down, you know where Chewell Parish Church is, All Saints Chewell, in Chewell Village, and the Abbey Pub, Chewell Abbey Pub, you know it? If you look at where the church is, the graveyard slopes down the back towards, is it Gattaca Park Drive, runs along the bottom. Jackson's Pond used to be down there. Anyone ever go fishing for sticklebacks and Jack Sharps down in Jackson's Pond? No, you're all much younger than me, so that's probably why I filled in now. That was where the leper colony was, because the Chewell Brook used to run along the... Well, it still does. Chewell Brook is culverted, though, in that particular section. So there's a water supply for the lepers. Now, of course, before the Reformation, in King Henry VIII's time particularly, you were required to go to church. You had to, by law. Everybody had to go to church. So the Chewell church bells would ring out early on Sunday mornings. This was the church for the whole area. They would come from West Derby, even West Derby, from Knotty Ash, from Old Swan, from Broad Green. The Norris family from Speke Hall would come from Speke to the morning services at All Saints Parish Church, because that was the church. Okay. The lepers had to come to church too. As soon as the bell started ringing, they would make their way up the hill towards the church. But of course, they couldn't go in the church. They were excluded for both of the reasons that I said. So the priest would wait until all the congregation was in, then he would close the church doors. By that time, the lepers had all made their way up from the leper colony and were outside the church. Everyone was required by law to make confession. Everyone was Catholic in those days. You had to make a confession regularly, again, by law. Punishment by fine or disfigurement if you didn't. Get your lips cut off, or your nostrils slit, or your ears removed. So you had to go. But that meant the lepers too. Well, how could the priest hear their confessions? The hagioscope. You can still see what's left of it today. Next time you're in Chewell, there's a lich gate. You know what a lich gate is? Yeah? It's, lich means corpse. It's a gate with a roof over the top into the churchyard. They used to rest the coffins under the roof of the lich gate, the corpse gate, and that's where the funeral service would actually begin. Then they carry it into the church and carry it on there. But if you go through the lich gate, there's the great sandstone war memorial cross in the grounds. Go behind the cross, the wall of the church, look at the ground level. You will see the top of a window. It's a Gothic window. It comes to a point at the top, but it's right at ground level. There's only about 18 inches of it showing, but it's glazed. And if you look down, there's a sort of grill in the ground there. You look behind the grill, you can see that the window goes down only about another 2 feet, really. But it's in an arch, a recess, that had clearly been built into the side of the church. If you actually go inside the church, you can see the opposite number, if you like, to that recess in the wall of the church interior. It's the height of a man, and it is a recess. And in fact, what would happen is the priest would stand in that recess, and all the lepers would line up one by one, stand in that recess and make their confession through a grill, and the priest would give them absolution. But how's that possible when the ground level is... That's because the level of the churchyard at Chewell has been raised at least 4 times. And that's true of most ancient churches in Britain. You didn't bury people 6 feet deep, you just didn't. You bury him until, you know, we're just covered with earth. Dig a hole just deep enough to get the body in and then just fill him in. No crosses either. Before or about the mid-17th century, you didn't have tombstones or crosses or anything like that, any marker at all, unless you were an aristocrat or had delusions of grandeur and the money to afford one. You were buried and you were forgotten, right, except by your family. But of course, in those days, most people were born, lived and died in their villages. Didn't live for very long either. No family planning, so large families, lots of them dying prematurely. The graveyards very soon filled up. And before long, you want to bury Uncle Jim, and you're digging up the bones of your great-aunt Fanny, and it's a bit of a problem. So they put an extra layer of soil on the top, and then they had another level of it. Well, that soon, after 30, 40, 50, 100 years, would fill up too. So you put another layer on. And we estimate that in Chewell there are at least four layers of bodies, which means that probably there is an Anglo-Saxon burial site right at the bottom of all of these. And of course, over the years, the level of the graveyard has risen and obscured the original leper squint full height of it. But the top of it is still there from outside. Inside, you can see it all. There are only four hagioscopes, leper squints, left in the British Isles. We've got one of them. I told you the world revolves around us. I'm going to finish now with the tale of Camp Hill. We'll be done by 3:15. Is that okay? Yeah? I could tell you about the Tudor schoolhouse in Walton Village, where the Catholic martyr St. John Armand was a pupil, but I won't. Or I could tell you about the fascinating history of Walton Woods, or the quarry, stone from which built Liverpool Anglican Cathedral, or how Paul McCartney met John Lennon 60 years ago in 1958 in St. Peter's Church in Walton. I'm not going to tell you anything about them at all. I'm going to go right back to our earliest years. Not as far back as the Coldstones, but I'm going back 2,000 years to when Camp Hill was occupied by the local tribespeople, the Celtic tribespeople, known as the Brigantes. These were a fierce, warlike tribe. In fact, there were probably tribes of Brigantes at the time on Everton Ridge as well, may even have been some on Olive Mount. The thing about these tribespeople were, they were fierce and warlike. And if there was no one else to fight, they'd fight amongst themselves. It was very scouse, really, when you think about it. And they were hunter-gatherers as well. And at the top of Camp Hill, they built an encampment. That's why it's called Camp Hill. And it's been known as Camp Hill for hundreds and hundreds of years. But the evidence that there was actually at some point a prehistoric encampment was only actually confirmed, other than by local rumour, in the 1830s, when archaeologists first started excavating at the top of the hill and found the remnants of this encampment, possibly for about 200 to 500 tribespeople, men, women and children, so a large settlement. But if you think about the top of Camp Hill, well, yes, it could sustain that. And a stockade with great carved iron logs and spikes sticking out as defences all the way around. They kept their livestock inside the stockade as well. They had arable land inside the stockade, although because it was such a large population, they would have also had farmlands outside, so they were cultivating crops outside. But if they were under attack by anyone at all, they were fierce people indeed. Now, 2,000 years ago is when the Romans invaded Britain, of course. Now, this was a very settled community, but the Romans came here first of all in 44 BC under the command of Julius Caesar. They were only in Britain for 3 months and then they left. And no one's really quite sure why. Why did Julius Caesar turn and go? Why did he not try and conquer the rest of the country? It wasn't until AD 54, under Emperor Claudius, that the Romans came again and invaded Britain, only stayed here and worked their way up. So AD 54. 54. We reckon it was about AD 150, 200 possibly, that they got to the northwest. Took them that long to work their way up the country, to get up to here, to northwest. Hacking and slashing and beheading all the way. And every time they conquered a local tribesman, a chieftain, chop his head off, put it on a spike as warnings to everybody else, alongside all the Roman roads that they were building as they made their way up to Dever, which was Chester, and ultimately up to Ribchester in Lancashire, which was their headquarters here. We know that the Romans walked along what is now St Mary's Road in Garston, because when they were actually building St Mary's Church, they discovered the Roman pavement under the church. People are still turning over their gardens in Garston, Egbert, and Fulwood Park, and all around there, and digging up Roman coins. Not so much now, but, you know, they still do. So this was obviously a thoroughfare. And for years, no one was sure whether or not the Romans actually settled anywhere around here. Did they just pass through? But about 10 years ago, evidence was discovered in Woolton of a Roman settlement. So it's now believed that they did actually have an encampment themselves. Why? Camp Hill. If there's a massive fortification, a fairly warlike brigantes at the top of the hill, you're going to need to capture that hill. Why again? Because it's forested. Well, woods, it's all that's left of it. But wood, timber for building, ships, everything, absolutely perfect. The views are tremendous because you can see right across through what is now Liverpool, right through the North Kirkdale Forest and beyond, right across the River Mersey, no flats or anything like that to obstruct your view, perfect view of the Mersey and Wirral Peninsula, right across to Wales. You could see the Lancashire Plain, south and east you could see the Cheshire Plain, a real vantage point the Romans wanted. I've got visions of the Romans standing at the bottom of Camp Hill, along what is now Hillfoot Road, in all their serried, disciplined ranks, with their shields and their javelins and their broadswords, in immaculate armour, burnished so it shone, their leather and their thongs and their sandals, all organised, perfectly disciplined. And what have we got 2,000 years ago? Early versions of Scousers on the top of the hill, standing there, doing the early Anglo-Saxon version of "Come on, you right eyes, if you think you're hard enough." You can see it, can't you? They fought naked, the Brigantes, men, women, and children. And what they would do is they'd get limestone and crush it and mix it with water and rub it into all their body hair. When I say all, I mean all. And they'd twist it all into spikes like this. And this is only the women. Which made them look really fierce, and they paint their bodies either entirely blue or with blue patterns on it, swirls and spots and everything, from woad, which is a juice extracted from the woad plant, uses a body dye. And there they all are, lined up on the top of the hill in this unruly, raucous mob. I mean, even the most hard-bitten soldier, seeing that lot jumping up and down, waving all their weapons at them, and to hear them come screaming down the hill would be bad enough, but to see them charging, flapping, flashing, and flailing, it's like Goodison Park on a Saturday afternoon. It put the fear of God up the Romans, I'm quite sure of it, which is perhaps why no Roman encampment evidence has ever been found on the top of the hill. Which brings me back to what I was saying earlier. You take on a Scouser at your peril. And even the Romans discovered that. We've run out of time. What I've done is I've given you a whistle-stop tour around the Seven Hills, and I've only chosen one story to tell you from each of those hills. And I've indicated the others that I could have told you. They still are just scratching the surface. Because this is a wonderful city. And all of these suburbs of our city were once villages, townships, communities in their own right. I sometimes call them the lost and found villages. Because they're lost. But not really. Because themselves. They're all still there. And the evidence of their independence, their heritage, their history, and the fascinating curiosity of their people is all still there if you know where to look. Thank you very much. Thank you.